Ci avviamo ora verso l'esaurimento di quello che era il panel originariamente previsto con l'intervento del professor Philipp Schlesinger, che è professore di politica culturale e direttore accademico del Centro per la ricerca sulla politica culturale dell'Università di Glasgow, ma che anche, e forse soprattutto dal punto di vista sempre del tema del nostro convegno, presidente del Comitato Consultivo Scozzese sul problema del servizio pubblico della televisione e dei media pubblici. Professor Schlesinger.
Grazie, signor Presidente. Felice di non essere l'ultimo. Non voglio esaurire la pazienza dell'audienza. Parlo in inglese, però prima di iniziare il mio discorso vorrei ringraziare agli organizzatori per l'invito. È un piacere vero rinnovare i miei legami con il Premio Italia e anche di venire qui a Torino. This meeting has set itself a major challenge, and I'd like to note some of the preconditions of the idea of a European public service, principally by reflecting on the British experience in the wider European context. And there is a risk of repeating things that have already been said, and I shall try to avoid it. And I do not agree with everything that's been said, so I hope there will be some space for debate. I think it's important also, since there's a possibility of being cast in the role of the Eurosceptic, for me to say that I'm not a Eurosceptic, because I think that tutto sommato European integration has been a constructive process, particularly given the bloody European past. And, you know, this is what Europe is about, after all. And Europeanization offers a modest possibility of cosmopolitanism, I think, within the frame of a Eurocosmos. And that's potentially a counterweight to the dark anti-democratic side of nationalism. And it's always wise to recognize that politics can produce surprises, so we should not assume that the European Union is itself immune to anti-democratic tendencies. It's perhaps, you know, more notably a Europe of security than a Europe of communication. I think these are things that concern me personally, I have to say. So I begin with the strong sense that although Europeanization is ambivalent in its effects, and despite the fact that a democratic deficit exists, and notwithstanding that the European Union remains a mainly elite-driven project, that the alternatives are certainly worse. And a last introductory point. It's not fashionable to say it today, but it seems that the hopes invested in the idea of a European public service television are actually enlightenment hopes. The aspiration is for a communicative space that, broadly speaking, constitutes the citizen as a rational being and equips him or her with the capacity to engage in reasoned argument and debate. So the reality, as we know, is rather different. But the official goals of public service do reflect this rather venerable aspiration and are not to be easily jettisoned. Of course, public service broadcasting is not the embodiment of pure reason. We would not bother watching or listening if it were. Post-millennium television, public as well as private, offers a gamut of engagements, stimuli and pleasures, as well as intolerable boredom and mind-numbing banality. Well, let me first now turn to the question of Europeanization, because my talk is divided into three. First, about Europeanization. Secondly, about public service in the UK. And thirdly, the national question in the UK, which I think is important, not least in the light of what's been said about our multiple identities coexisting easily. In the post-Soviet era, Europeanization has been marked by an expansion of competencies and of territory by the European Union. And the idea that shared communication is a prerequisite for the formation of a European democracy has been central to current debate, both political and academic. And we've gone through a number of attempts to engineer this aspect of a public sphere into existence, which have been reflected in the discussion so far. So I won't repeat that. And this development has been paralleled by the related aspirations that began more than two decades ago as a European information space, which has evolved into seeking to install a knowledge society in line with the Lisbon Agenda. Now, here the driving forces have been those of global economic competitiveness and technological change, not least now advances in the digital economy. And alongside this, the European Union context is also marked by the uncertain growth of a European cultural space with increasing prominence given to the culture programmes of the Commission since the year 2000. Now, these can be seen as Europeanising trends, but the real driving force of a communicative space would be the creation of a common political space, I still think. And that is blocked, and everyone is waiting for the Irish to make a decision. And the Irish will make a decision, and that will not resolve anything, in my opinion. I think we need, importantly, to distinguish between demand and supply-led conceptions of the relationship between television and its audiences, because these relate to top-down and bottom-up conceptions of the polity. A completely supply-side-driven Euro-public service model would not work. Television's relationships with its audiences, especially, and this has been noted already, as the digital revolution unfolds and introduces greater complexity into the modes of distribution, those relationships raise questions about the role of consumption in the process of Europe building. Which are the contents that might be thought most important for common consumption? Well, news has been talked about, but typically news is actually national or local in its mode of address, most successfully so. The Champions League and Eurovision produce large event-based transnational audiences, but they also bring together divergent loyalties. So we divide on tribal lines when coming together, which is certainly better than war, but nonetheless, it's tribalism. To my mind, there's very little evidence that there's strong cross-national demand for others' programming within the EU. And, you know, aspirations have been expressed today. I remain sceptical on that question, not on the European project, I hasten to say. Television programmes circulate. Formats may be actually more important in bringing about a kind of cultural conformity, cultural uniformity in games shows, talent competitions, and reality television. But the prevalent mode of consumption seems to be framed by national frameworks of supply and modes of address. And of course, and this again has been mentioned, the European space remains linguistically and culturally divided, irrespective of the rise of English as a lingua franca. Yes, there is mobility. The mobility is, it's not as extensive as people often think, and therefore I think its consequences are not likely to be as great in terms of bringing about cultural change. Citizen building and social integration are seen as key desirable outcomes in the briefing paper for this meeting. They're top-down aspirations. That doesn't make them bad or wrong, and many citizens may share them. Although across the member states, the Eurobarometer survey suggests that there's really no consistency over time about how much citizens imagine themselves to be Europeans. And it's also the case that a European dimension to television can take many possible forms. And one of the questions, you know, which we haven't yet posed is, well, if you're citizen building and if you're seeking social solidarity, what kind of Europe is it that we're talking about? Is it the welfare state or the market? Is it nations or a federation? Is it elite-led or democratic? And then what are the limits of Europe? Who belongs and who doesn't? And why? And these are very live questions. Who do the frontiers hold at bay? And I think one of the problems is that in a political formation that is inherently unstable, at least at the moment, in its territorial extent, it is actually quite difficult to settle this question of public service television, or public service of any kind, actually, which is transnational. Let me now go on to talk about public service television and talk specifically about the United Kingdom, where we don't talk about public service television and we don't talk about public service media, we talk about public service broadcasting still, I think, and then public service contents. And I think we are in a moment of change in the vocabulary that we're using, but the debate in the UK is centred not only on television but on radio and also on particularly the internet, and particularly as that relates to the BBC. Now, the arguments about public service broadcasting raise questions about the relations between content and institutions and distribution systems more generally, and how these affect the brand and identity of what is on offer and its modes of consumption. If a European public service television were conceivable, it's difficult also to imagine it without a correlative form of European regulation. And of course, the European Union, as has been discussed, set some basic norms for content and the recognition of what is a public service and what is not. But these are actually open to very diverse interpretations and diverse enforcement regimes. In the UK, the question of public service has increasingly needed to be defended by reference to public value. Now, public value is actually a framework of justification that substitutes for so-called market disciplines. In the UK, Ofcom, the Office of Communication, and the BBC Trust apply so-called public value tests and market impact tests in order to assess whether or not a new service should be launched. The existence of this kind of regulatory body depends on a particular political culture and institutional history, and we might ask to what extent such practices could be reproduced at a European level. And I think a great deal has been said to show the national particularity of the relationship between politics, policy, and existing communication systems. So I do think that's an interesting, possibly insurmountable question. And I would also say that it's early to go down the route of post-institutionalism. Institutions remain very, very important and in public service broadcasting, and particularly in the UK, the continued existence of the BBC as an institution, not just as a public service supplier, I think is rather key. And people may well know that at the Edinburgh International Television Festival just a month ago, James Murdoch, the son of Rupert Murdoch of News Corporation, followed his father in attacking public service institutions and regulation. And so I think this is a very, very important area of public debate. And there are indeed complex questions and legitimate questions to be asked at the time of economic crisis in commercial radio and television and the press about the BBC's range of activities. It's perfectly legitimate to ask those questions and the extent to which those affect the converging marketplace in the digital age. The BBC has an extraordinary web presence funded by the license fee, and this is a sore point for competing press interests, particularly, that wish to profit from their content. And for the broadcasting competitors, the BBC's financial stability is a particular irritation in an advertising downturn and recessionary climate.
Now, alongside minutes, these, professor.
Sì, quanto? Cinque. Sì, va bene, è possibile. Okay. The political debate in the UK at the moment is focused on the licence fee and on the extent to which the BBC should remain at its present size. And this is coming both from the left, if the Labour Party is the left, and from the Conservative Party. Yes, that is the right. It's coming from both of those directions. The whole mode of regulation of the BBC is also being questioned. And now let me just go to my last point, because I think this is an important one, and it hasn't really been addressed. And that is the way in which, if you like, sub-state nationalism, I think, is something we need to take account of, perhaps more critically than has been alluded to. Identity politics in Europe is not a politics without contradictions. We have an uncomfortable multiculturalism at the present time, but we also have a politics of nationalism, both at the level of states, but within states too. So let me just, from a Scottish point of view, say a few things about that and try to do this in the next 3 minutes. The UK is a state of nations that has given its component nations additional political institutions. In the case of Scotland, political devolution has institutionalized tensions between the centre and periphery over broadcasting policy. The Scottish National Party government set up something called the Scottish Broadcasting Commission in 2007 to address Scotland's economic, cultural, and democratic needs from broadcasting. So this is not the UK government. A key recommendation was to set up a Scottish digital network funded by London with the licence fee a likely source. Demands for increased investment in production and more control over public service provision in Scotland have also reached a new level of articulation. And I think you would find similar things going on, say, in Spain. And then we have internal competitive regionalism as the Greater Manchester area is built up, and this is at the expense of other parts of the UK. So there are questions around the capacity of the existing system to sustain the creative economy throughout the UK and to provide an adequate form of cultural representation at the level of the state. This is a political question, it's also a regulatory question, and it's one of broadcasting practice. And we have general elections next year, in before May 2010, and there is undoubtedly political capital to be gained by the nationalist government in Edinburgh if London fails to meet these demands. So this is very much on the agenda. Now, finally, with I think 1 minute to go, there is a broader point to be made. Within the wider European context, the question of nations within member states and how these might articulate with a transnational public sphere is being posed afresh. To put it differently, there are centripetal as well as centrifugal forces at work. Not all identities sit comfortably together. So I began this intervention with reflections on the European level, and have ended up talking about the nation, in what remains such an unresolved European space, should we be surprised? Thank you. Grazie, signor Presidente.
Grazie, professor Schlesinger. Due considerazioni. Una, che l'europeismo deve essere proprio un po' perduto se nel nostro convegno una delle voci meno euroscettiche è in fondo quella di un britannico, forse perché è quella di uno scozzese, non lo so, che è un po' diversa da quella di un inglese. E poi anche un brivido di, non voglio dire terrore, ma quasi a pensare che l'unica identità europea sia poi affidata al fatto che dovunque vada ritrovo l'Isola dei Famosi o il Grande Fratello in format così simili che mi sento a casa, perché anche se non capisco la lingua tanto so la situazione che si sta svolgendo. Tra l'altro non è molto europeo, perché è abbastanza copiato dall'America. Sì, però sia il Grande Fratello che l'Isola dei Famosi li hanno fatti prima in America. Assolutamente sì. Almeno per quanto riguarda l'Isola dei Famosi, sicurissimo. Sul Grande Fratello lascio l'affermazione da parte.